Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to episode 11 of Ask Andrew. In this time like last, it gets to be Ask Andrew and Karen. Now, in the previous episode, we talked a little bit about Dorothy Sayers' essay and why it was so successful, so effective, why it was so popular. And one of the things that came out of that was the idea of the ordering of things, the structure of a child's development, what you might call the curriculum. Well, today we're going to talk about two questions related to the curriculum. And the first one is very simple. What is the classical curriculum? So I suppose I could, Karen, turn to you and say, what do you think? What is the classical curriculum? But that might not be fair to you. So I'll give you the opportunity. Would you like to answer
you
that?
Go right ahead, and okay. I'll just jump in.
Okay, you oh boy, he's just going to jump in. Okay, so the first thing I want to say about the curriculum is mistakes that we make. And I can point to Dorothy Sayers on this one, as well as to Mortimer Adler, to Jacques Barzun, to the medieval educators, Hugh of St. Victor. I can point to Quintilian. I can point to Aristotle. One of the biggest mistakes we make when we think of curriculum is that we think in terms of subjects. And thinking in terms of subjects is a very modern error, and I consider it to be, do I want to say it's the fatal error? I think it's a really, really big mistake. Thinking in terms, the curriculum is not the subjects you study. The second mistake we make is that we think it's the books that we read, or worse, that it's the textbooks that we read. The curriculum is neither the subjects we study, nor is it the textbooks we read. The curriculum, well, I mean, one way to look at it is to say it comes from the old Latin word curriculum. And as I understand it, that means running in a circle, but it has the idea of it's a horse racetrack. It's if you go to the hippodrome and you watch, you know, Ben-Hur or something, you watch the horses run around the track, they're running on the curriculum. The curriculum is I like to say that when you get the kids in the curriculum, you get them running in circles, and the goal is to, and subject literally means to throw under. So what you want to do is get the kids running in circles so that you can throw them under the bus. But that's not really it. That's not what a curriculum is. The curriculum is the whole experience that a child has. And so one of the points that I'd like to make here is that you cannot dissociate the child's mind from his wider experience. One of the first things that makes up the curriculum for the child is the physical atmosphere, the physical environment in which he's abiding, in which he's dwelling. And basically, put it this way, the space that a person occupies is what he will study whether you mean him to or not. He's going to look at the walls, the floor, the desks, if there are desks. He's going to look at the physical environment, and that's going to be a very quiet, most of the time, but a very constant statement to him of values and beliefs and commitments of the institution or the home where he's studying. So we have to start, when we think about the curriculum, talking about the physical environment as something that he does learn from. Lockers in the hallway, what does that teach a child? Desks in rows and columns, what does that teach a child? Maybe a U-shape, what does that teach a child? Do you want to add anything to that point there? That the physical environment is part of his curriculum.
Just that the whole home is educating or not educating the child. And so everything that you do from the time they wake up in the morning until the bedtime story is part of their education. And their education isn't just happening when they have their books in front of them at the table in the chair. And so we need to be careful of the culture that we're providing in the home, intentionally or not intentionally.
I like that word culture. The Greek word for that is paideia, and that's the exact same word that they use for education. In Greek thought, so far as I've been able to tell, they don't even have the ability to distinguish between culture and education. It's the same thing. And so when a Greek child wakes up in the morning, he gets up in a Greek bed, puts his feet on a Greek floor, walks across a Greek floor to a Greek door, walks through the Greek door into a Greek room where there's a Greek table with Greek food on it, prepared by a Greek mother and a Greek father, and they talk to each other in Greek. Maybe there's Greek bookshelves on the shelf, or scrolls. Then he walks out onto a Greek street where he walks past Greek gods, up the Panathenic Way to a Greek temple, into a Greek marketplace. All of these things come together to make that child, to form that child into being a Greek. It's the paideia of the Greeks. And the phrase that Paul uses in Ephesians chapter 6, where he says to bring up your children, he says to fathers, don't provoke them to wrath, but bring them up on the nurture and the paideia of the Lord. And that's what we're trying to discover and to develop in our curriculum, is the paideia of the Lord. And that's not just books, and it's not just intellectual. It's going to be personal. Remember that we're teaching a temple, we're teaching an image, and we're teaching a person. And if we forget any of those, we won't teach them the way they need to be taught. So I really appreciate your point that it's the whole home. It's all that you do from the beginning of the day to the end. So in other words, we don't even need to think about books, do we? We don't even need to think about the content. We just have to have a good, positive experience all day long, right?
Well, that would be nice.
You look hesitant.
No, of course we have to think about the content. They're feeding on the content, and their skills are developed by while they engage with the content.
It strikes me as you say that their skills are huge. And then secondly, what? Values, attitudes are formed, appreciations. They're going to come to appreciate some things and not appreciate others. And it would be nice if we were all autonomous beings who naturally appreciated the right things, but it isn't like that. So one of the things we need to ask ourselves then is why, given that the curriculum is not the books or textbooks and it's not subjects, why do we need books? Dorothy Sayers said in her essay, although we often succeed in teaching our pupils subjects, we fail lamentably on the whole in teaching them how to think. And then she says, modern education concentrates on teaching subjects, listen to this, leaving the method of thinking, arguing, and expressing one's conclusions to be picked up by the scholar as he goes along. Medieval education, she says, concentrated on it on first forging and learning to handle the tools of learning. I think that might be the most valuable sentence in the whole essay. Because I would even say it wasn't just medieval. Medieval education did that at its high point because it was reading Aristotle. And Aristotle begins with the Organon. And then you can study his other subjects, if you want to call them subjects. He would have called them sciences, and I'll come back to that. But if you remember earlier, I talked about the seven liberal arts. I think it was episode 7 or around then, 6, 7, something like that. I talked about the seven liberal arts, and I mentioned that Aristotle developed the organon. That's what Dorothy Sayers is going back to, the seven liberal arts. And they're called liberal arts, or I even prefer to call them now the liberating arts of truth, perception, and harmony, because they're arts, first of all, and an art is a way of doing something or making something, and they're liberating because they enable us to see truth, right? Now, the modern world does not believe in knowable truth. Not believing in knowable truth, it doesn't teach people how to discover knowable truth. And what I'm arguing is it doesn't teach people the seven liberal arts. It teaches them the wrong curriculum. And as much as we can, we have to live in our circumstances and be fruitful there. But as much as we can, I think we need to separate ourselves from a subject-oriented approach, because that's honestly, that's easy to be tyrannical with. Who decides on the subject? Whoever's in charge. And they can make any subject for credit, whatever they want. But nature tells us, the human nature tells us, there are certain things we need to learn how to do to be effective. We need to learn how to use language well. We need to learn how to communicate well. We need to learn how to think well. If we can't do those things well, we can't do anything like we ought to be doing it. So therefore, the arts, the organon, as Aristotle called it, or the seven arts as they developed in the Middle Ages, those are the curriculum. And those are all preparatory. They are arts that prepare us to make something. And what they prepare us to make, quite frankly, most immediately, is knowledge, which in Latin is scientia. So once you have mastered the seven liberal arts, the fulfillment of the curriculum in a classical tradition would be the sciences. And there are stages to the sciences. There's the sciences that are pretty precise and clear, pretty measurable, and those are the physical sciences where you can apply math to movement. And that would be chemistry, biology, physics, and all the variations thereon. Then there's a kind of science that you need to know differently, that math doesn't work for. That's the moral sciences, the humane sciences. Those need to be studied learning a different set of skills, and they need to be studied in a different way. That's why literature is so important, for example. Then there are the let's call them the, and ethics, by the way, would be a humane science. Then come the philosophical sciences, which would be, that's the really hard stuff that you shouldn't study till you're in your 40s, but that's you know, causes of causes. And finally, at the very pinnacle of the curriculum is theology, where we think about God himself. But you have to see that all of this depends on our mastery of the seven liberal arts. And for the Christian, it then in turn depends as well on purity of heart. And so you can't separate the intellectual from the moral development. So sorry to make you sit through all that, Karen. You've probably had to hear that a lot of times. But that's my understanding of the classical curriculum in the, call it the abstract, disconnected. It's about becoming human. Now, there's another question, though, and we've got about 2 minutes during which we can answer this question that was sent to us. And it came as an email under the heading, Developing a Curriculum on African Civilization. Wonderful question. We have a daughter in Africa right now, so this is very meaningful to me. She says, I would like to develop a classical curriculum. She lives in Kenya, I should say. I would like to develop a classical curriculum that delves into African civilization. Studying the Greeks and Romans and Hebrews, I believe, is foundational for us to appreciate our African culture and examine the beliefs, values, and morals that have undergirded this culture historically is imperative. I would like your thoughts on this. Well, me too. Let me rephrase that. I agree that it's imperative. One of the things that drives me as I think through education, I mentioned this in the last session, that it's about being human, right? That's what classical education is about. But as humans, we have duties. And education cannot teach us how to be human without also teaching us how to fulfill our duties. So I, myself, live in Concord, North Carolina. In order to fulfill my duties as a human being here in Concord, I need to know the English language well. I need to know local customs. I need to know state government, local government, United States government. That means I need to know American history because it's my duty. That means I need to know where our Constitution came from. And that drives me back through the Middle Ages, through the British tradition, all the way back to Rome, all the way back to Greece, all the way back to Jerusalem. I don't think you can be, I'll put it bluntly, I don't think you can be a good American citizen if you don't know American history, British history, Roman history, Greek history, and Hebrew history. At least if you don't know the ideas that, we got from them. Let me put it that way. That's why as Americans, we have to have, no matter who you are, you have to have an American education, classical education to be a good American. There, I've said it. The question then in Kenya, what about that? Does a Kenyan need to know American history? I would say no. I would say it would benefit them in some ways because it's interesting and our Constitution is fascinating. But they do need to know Kenyan history, and that does involve the British Empire. And the British Empire was not pure evil. They need to recognize the good that was in it. They need to view it objectively. They need to learn the African heritage that is part of Kenyan history, much of which is passed on orally and I hope still preserved. I know, for example, in Uganda, where our daughter is, most of that ancient or that oral tradition has been lost to where they don't even trust stories anymore. I don't know Kenya very well, but I believe that a Kenyan needs to be able to fulfill the duties of citizenship in the Republic, or I think it's a Republic of Kenya. Now, as a human, I think they ought to study grammar, logic, and rhetoric as arts. And as participants in modern society, they would benefit enormously from knowing Latin. It'd be great if they could also do Greek. And I mean here the ancient Greek and Latin. I think they would benefit from that. But I think you also have to weave in whatever it requires for them to fulfill their duties as Kenyans. That, to me, is the practical, immediate part of a classical education that can't be set aside. All right, you've been patiently enduring while I've gone on and on. Did you want to add anything, well, especially given that Katie's over there?
I would add that one of the ways in which we judge a book's worthiness to put in front of our children, through which we can develop their skills, whether it's reading, listening, narrating, writing, is whether truth, goodness, and beauty is expressed in the story. And so I can think of lots of American books for children in which those things are expressed. But somebody in Kenya wouldn't need to use those because there would be Kenyan fairy tales or Kenyan folk tales, through which truth, goodness, and beauty is expressed. And that would make wonderful, wonderful stories to be read, to be talked about, poems to be memorized. There's a lot of culture there that would be wonderful to use.
That's fantastically well put. And let me add something about talking with Katie, and then we got to end with this. Katarina is our daughter in Uganda, and she was describing for me recently, a number of times, how much better her African students tend to understand Homer because the customs and traditions of Homeric Greek civilization are much closer to, in some ways, the Ugandan customs and traditions, which I find really fascinating. And her students, possibly because she's such a great teacher, but her students have loved doing Homer with her. She told us a story about standing on the wall while they acted out the Hector-Achilles battle, stuff like that. It's really fun. So we're out of time. I'm sorry. This question of the cross-cultural is such a big deal to me because I'll just say I don't believe classical education will come anywhere near fulfilling its purpose if all it can educate, I'll overstate it, if all we can see it serving well is suburban whites. Now, it already has gone beyond that. I don't mean that, as an insult to anybody, but if it only applies to suburban white people so that they can keep their alt-right culture going, I'm putting this in as nasty terms as I possibly can, then I want no part in it. But if it's human, then I want completely to be immersed in it because I believe that the human being is the image of God, and that's what we're trying to cultivate. So I hope this has been a helpful answer to the question. I know these questions are so much deeper than my answers, and then the time is up. This one's gone really long. Please forgive me, but may the Lord remember you in his kingdom. Thank you.